Next case on the calendar is A23-0111, Apana versus Kamimailia.
Kankamala is, Apana is my client and Kankamala is the other.
Kankamala, thank you.
And which side would you like, ma'am? Does it matter?
Appellant should be over on this side here and respondent on that side.
Morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is Thursday, June 15th, 2023. This is our second of three cases on our oral calendar today. As I mentioned earlier, it's A23-0111, and I'm going to give it another try. Apana versus Kankamala. Okay. And attorney for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. The podium, there's a button underneath so you can raise and lower the podium as you see fit. And when you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, Presiding Judge Reyes, counsel, it's good to see you again. I am Jack DeWalt, D-E-W-A-L-T, appearing on behalf of appellant, Mr. Anil, and I'll spell the full name, Anil Kankamala, A-N-I-L-K-O-N-K-I-M-I-L-L-A. My client is asking this court to remand the district court order filed on December 24th, 2022. As it pertains to the allocation and division by the district court of the party's marital estate. To begin, Your Honors, as noted by correspondence yesterday, and Mr. Kankamala is asking the court to withdraw his request to appeal the first issue that was briefed as it relates to the marital businesses. Certainly understands the timing of that issue and understands, you know, how the court wants to handle that. But circumstances have changed, rendering that issue moot as regards to the arguments that Mr. Kankamala presented to the court.
And so, for the record, we did receive that. So thank you very much, counsel.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor. As to the other claim, which would be briefed as number two by appellant, Mr. Kankamala is still asking the court to find that the district court abused its discretion in its allocation of property as part of the divorce. As set forth in the briefs, that allocation of the marital estate between the parties resulted in an award of 71% of the net marital assets, while also omitting over $3.5 million in personally guaranteed debt. So the allocation with regard to the marital estate that is being challenged by appellant really comes down to three primary arguments, Your Honors. One, district court failed to make adequate findings as required by statute. Two, that the allocation itself was inequitable. And three, that by the omission of the personal guaranteed debt, that was clear error by the district court.
Before you go down and start talking about these, I just want to understand the impact of the bankruptcy proceeding and the orders that have been issued in that case. How does that impact, if at all, the issue that remains before this court?
I'm not entirely certain that it would, Your Honors. And the reason I say, first of all, I do preface that I don't make my living doing bankruptcy law, so I do apologize. But at the time of the trial, the business that was primarily the revenue-generating business of the parties, which would be called StoreWorks, had been in reorganization bankruptcy since 2019. And that had been going on at the time of trial. It had been going on for years. And StoreWorks was a functioning entity at the time of trial. Due to the net assets that were contained within StoreWorks, as found by Judge Burns in its district court order, the assets themselves of businesses were valued at zero. So the allocation of the businesses actually had no monetary effect on the division of the estate.
No, but there are personal guarantees, and I'm just wondering how the bankruptcy situation affects or impacts those assets, if at all.
No, I understand the question as it relates to the personal guarantees, Your Honor. Thank you for the clarification. The personal guarantees, is my understanding, are a second line claim in the event that the company itself were to default or not pay on the debts themselves. So in that sense, the personal guarantees, I think, are a valuable asset for consideration in the omission because they were personally guaranteed solely by Mr. Konkamala.
Now, you don't cite any case law, I don't think, on the proposition that a personal guarantee is the type of standalone debt. Like you say, it's a secondary thing. I'm curious whether you found any case law at all on the subject.
I was relying on statute, Your Honor, of 518.58, which is that any and all assets and acquired during the course of the marriage are presumed to be marital. So I think that...
Right, but a personal guarantee as... I can imagine a situation where this... let's say there's a debt that is covered by collateral and there's sufficient assets for it, and... A party says, sure, I'll provide a personal guarantee, knowing that there is virtually no practical chance of ever having to pay on it. And then it becomes part of the calculation in a dispute like this. I'm just curious if you're concerned or whether we should be concerned if we go down that course. Have you found any cases where we're applying the personal guarantee in the way that you ask us to apply it here?
I haven't, Your Honor, but I'll be honest. The reason why is because the scope of the statute in 518.58 is plain on its face. It identifies that any asset and liability acquired during the course of the marriage is presumed to be marital.
No, I understand that. There's no question about that, but I'm just, you know, is it really a liability? Are we sure it's a liability?
Yeah.
Is it certainly it wouldn't be a liability in every case, the circumstance I just described to you.
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that it is a liability. I think it is a clear liability. The real question is it a liability that will ever become due? And I think that's a valid question and a question that, you know, remains to be seen. And the district court, you know, certainly, I think, could have addressed. But I don't think there's any dispute, Your Honor, that the personal guarantees are a real liability. And we know that because in the event that they are not paid in a different way, appellant will have to pay them.
And right, but that's always the case with a personal guarantee if there's other sources of covering it. But in any case, in this case, we don't have any district court analysis of it one way or the other.
You don't, Your Honor, and I think that's one of the challenges is it was entirely omitted. There wasn't even a description as to say we're not going to treat this as a liability for purposes of the marital estate, ergo it's treated as a non-marital debt, for example.
Although, is it consistent with, and I acknowledge it would be our court would have an easier job if there were more findings.
Yeah.
But I mean, overall, I look at the division, and it appears that the district court, in trying to make an equitable division, you know, pretty much down the line, assigned to each party their individual accounts and individual liabilities. And so wouldn't we read this, the not dealing with these personal guarantees or omitting discussion of them in the award as sort of consistent with what the court's approach was overall to kind of leave to the parties? These are sophisticated parties, you know, especially your client who operate out these businesses. And you know, was there some sense that the court was just leaving with the party who took on that guarantee that debt?
Two things, Your Honor. One, the function of the district court isn't to omit assets and allow this court then to infer intent. The structure of the district court is to apply factors as set forth in statute so that this court has the ability to understand the reasoning for the allocation. That's clear error. Two, if we then apply the analysis that the court has identified, we result in two things. One is an allocation without the personal guarantees of 71% of positive assets in favor of one party and 29% in favor of the other, which I think based on case law is extreme and is not saying it can't be upheld. It is unusual to uphold an award of that extreme division. And two, If we then take the idea that the personal guarantees actually are a liability acquired during the course of the marriage and that they are solely payable by one individual and they're over $3.5 million, and if, and I know that's about the third or fourth if that I've used in that sentence, Your Honors, and I recognize the theoretical nature of that, but if they come due, we've now compounded the allocation to a degree, I briefed it, Your Honor, but I think it comes out to roughly about $2.5 million of net. Now, liability as opposed relates to my client, and I think give or take, again, to some odd million of the positive. So to the point, Your Honor, is that, one, it isn't actually sufficient to say as a court at the district court level, I'm going to apply this line of reasoning here, ergo the court should just infer that I'm also sort of bootstrapping in this significant number. However we want to view it, that's a failure under statute 518.58.
Is there a requirement? I mean, I understand that there are many statutes within this area of law that require specific findings, right, like best interest findings and things like that. These aren't those issues, are they? I mean, isn't the adequacy issue really go to this court's ability to review the district court's exercise of its discretion?
It does, but the reason that the statute is set forth that requires those findings to be made is for that review. So 518.58, which is a property statute that we're working under, says the court shall make findings, particularly when you're doing a disproportionate division. Case law will tell us that if you have a long-term marriage, an equal division is presumed to be equitable. I think that arguably findings are less important in that situation because the cases have told us that an equal division is presumptively equitable in a long-term marriage. Here, we then have this disproportionate division, and so the findings actually are necessary to support the disproportionality and to show the equitable nature because that's what's required. And those, again, just stating the ones enumerated in statute, length of marriage, prior marriages, age, health, occupations, income available, vocational skills, they're set forth by statute. And they're not meant to be, if the court chooses, they're meant to be as the court decides. And so, again, I understand also, Your Honors, that if there's information in the file that potentially could support the findings, a remand might not necessarily be appropriate either, just to have the district court exercise in making findings. Well, when we look at this case, when we look at this entire judgment and decree, Your Honors, two things stood out, and I'll just be very transparent. As soon as I saw it, I knew the order was problematic because it was 16 pages. 16 pages in a six-day trial covering issues of parenting time, property division, non-marital tracing, multiple businesses, multiple assets, spousal maintenance, child support. With all due respect to Judge Burns, who I have a high degree of respect for, it is almost impossible, I think, to make sufficient findings in 16 pages. And when we look at the findings of fact here, those actual findings of fact are less than three total pages.
Is there anything in the record that would suggest that the result would be different if we remanded for findings?
Yeah. I do think it would be, Your Honor, because if you would accept two things. One, that a disproportionate allocation of 71% net in favor of one and 29% net in favor of the other is inequitable with instructions, I think that outcome would be different. And two, if there's some instruction as to how to handle that personal guarantee and treat it as a marital asset, that significantly could alter the outcome of the case. So I do think, Your Honor, that the failure
assume all we did was to say we don't understand the rationale of the district court as to any of these things.
Yep.
Remand for findings and explanation for the allocation.
Understood, Your Honor.
Under that more general approach,
sure.
Is there anything in the record that would suggest that the district court would come to a different conclusion?
I think there is, Your Honor.
And what is that in the record?
I think you can look at the employability and occupation of the parties, respectively, and their incomes. And the reason I say that, my client's income was set by bankruptcy. It was capped at $100,000, give or take. Respondent's income has fluctuated over time, but it's roughly two times that. Roughly $200,000 plus. So when you look at the statutory factors, and they're saying, let's look at the incomes available to people, let's look at their occupations, look at their future earning potential, those factors do not favor, in my opinion, respondent.
Well, I was suggesting a different line of thought, which is there anything in the district court's rationale, anything in the proceedings that were where the district court suggested that this case would come out differently or not?
I could only speculate, Your Honor. Sure. And the reason I say that is the record is sparse, and it doesn't allow me even to infer in a devil's advocate scenario of trying to argue the other point where the judge was coming from. I do recognize the point that, in general, assets were allocated to one party and not to the other party. I recognize that line of reasoning. I don't find a lot of guidance to understand the why at all, either to support or disprove my claims. And so, so I do think, Your Honor, I'll wrap up here. The things that I think are important are what I have identified. Is that one? These are, I think they're clearly erroneous. You have a abject lack of findings, frankly, as required by statute. You have a division of assets that, even if you take the personal guarantees to the side, is extreme outside of the cases that we have referenced. And then three, that the omission entirely of the personal guarantee is an error resulting in harm to my client, given it was acquired during the marriage. Unless the court has other questions.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you, Your Honors. Excuse me. My name is Deborah Hillstrom, and I represent Deepika Apana, who was the original petitioner and is the respondent to the appeal. The district court did not err in making its findings. And when it divided the marital estate, it took into account all of the marital issues and the commingling of this marital estate with this business. The business was a marital asset. It was built together. They took significant marital money to build it, significant assets from my client, and ultimately that business ended up in bankruptcy. During the argument of the case, it was Mr. Kankamala's position that Judge Burns' hands were tied and were bound by the orders of the bankruptcy court.
So what is the impact? The question I asked appellant's counsel, what is the impact of the bankruptcy proceeding and orders on the remaining issues in this case?
So the bankruptcy order pretty much trumps everything else. And the testimony as it came in during trial was, if you don't like what the bankruptcy court said, take it to the bankruptcy court. And so as my client argued that she should be entitled to the $733,000 that was a marital asset that went into the business, the answer back was the bankruptcy court has already addressed that issue. When it comes to these personal guarantees that Mr. Kankamala continues to talk about, one, the personal guarantees were never presented to the district court. So there are no signed personal guarantees ever presented. These are guarantees of StoreWorks bills.
Was it a dispute that the guarantees were out there?
Absolutely. My client has never seen them. She never acknowledged that they existed. My client acknowledged that they made guarantees of the houses.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that there was a factual dispute as to the existence of the personal guarantee.
There was, and the bankruptcy court specifically addressed any personal guarantees and specifically gave language that said that as long as the pendency of the bankruptcy court was happening, no creditors could take action against any of the owners or against personal guarantees.
Here's what's difficult for me, is that the rationale that you're providing, well, it was a disputed issue as to whether there were any personal guarantees. If there was a personal guarantee, it was already accounted for. In the bankruptcy court. It would be really helpful for us not to have to infer that that's the reason the district court didn't consider the personal guarantee. And the same thing goes for the division of property and the debt being ascribed to one party versus the other. It seems to me that we would have to do, we would have to infer all of the rationale that we usually expect the district court to present to us when we're deciding both issues, but whether there are clearly erroneous fact findings and whether the district court acted within its discretion in the division of property. So am I correct about the absence of fact findings and the concern that we might have?
So I would argue that the district court had lots of facts that the parties all stipulated to. We stipulated to what the properties were. We gave the facts to the court, and we said, this is what you have to divide, Judge. And then these are the issues that we don't have agreement on, and you have to decide how to disperse them. The court doesn't have to make factual findings about things that the parties stipulate to and make long findings
about. But the parties didn't stipulate to a 70-30 split of the property, and the parties didn't stipulate to the debt going all to one party and not the other.
So I would argue that it isn't marital debt. And if you actually look at the analysis that the court did do, the court talked about $50,000 in previous orders being attorney's fees. So this was heavily litigated with lots of orders prior to trial. The $50,000 that Mr. Konkamala talks about from the 401k, he actually specifically stated in his affidavits that those were for attorney's fees. So when the court made the allocation that everybody pays their own attorney's fees, they addressed the $50,000. In addition, the $250,000 that Mr. Konkamala talks about in his appeal, that is business debt, and that's for taxes. And it's actually addressed specifically in the bankruptcy court. So if you look to the bankruptcy document, it specifically allocates the $250,000 to the business.
These are great arguments. This is everything you've just articulated, I will just say, would be really nice to have been in the order from the district court so we can see why the district court was treating the $50,000 as an attorney fee debt ascribed to one party and not the other. Why the $250,000 goes through the bankruptcy. It's difficult for us, speaking for myself, difficult for us to have to draw those inferences and then make decisions about whether that's within the court's discretion.
So Mr. Konkamala never presented $250,000 in tax debt to the court to divide. He raised it as an issue. There was testimony. We've said we even made a motion to compel discovery on some of these issues. We didn't receive it, and he didn't present it. You can't ask the court to divide something that you don't tell the court to divide and prove it exists. And so I would argue that the court did not err in assigning that to Mr. Konkamala because he didn't disclose it. He didn't provide it. He provided no tax statements. My client filed her taxes. She presented them. The court said she filed her taxes. She paid her liability. He didn't. He didn't provide it. He gets whatever debt there is that goes with it. And the bankruptcy court, again, assigned that to the business. And so if you read the bankruptcy document, it specifically says those $250,000 shall be paid from the business. And so it isn't marital debt if it's business debt.
Again, a district court finding of exactly what you just said would make things a whole lot easier for us on appeal.
So
that's the point I'm concerned about, the inferences that we have to draw, that all the arguments you're making are the rationale of the district court.
So I would argue that this is not a 71 split, and I would argue that Mr. Konkamala wants to keep the money that came in as business money. There was $3.5 million that came in during the pendency of the trial. So we were days into the trial. My client had rested her case. There was a settlement. $3.5 million came in. He does not want that to be considered as a marital asset. But he wants any debt that business might pay that he didn't pay with the $3.5 million to come in, that my client should take on that as a debt responsibility when it's a business debt. And so you don't get to have it both ways. You don't get to say to the court, oh, don't pay attention to that income. Oh, but here, pay attention to all this debt, especially when you don't present it to the court.
To explain to me, or point me in the record and in the district court's findings and conclusions of law, support for your assertion that this is not a 71-29 split?
Certainly. So if you look at the court's actual division, it specifically talks about liabilities. That's the $50,000, the 401k issue, which again was a loan that Mr. Konkamala took after the merit, the petition was already filed, and he took it out, and he specifically, in the findings on the order regarding whether or not Storworks was marital property and whether the home should be sold, the court specifically made a finding that that was taken out to pay attorney's fees. So then when the court made the finding that everybody pays their own attorney's fees, that is where that comes from. In addition, on the $250,000 in tax liability, the court specifically said, one, my client has paid her tax, he hasn't, and so he should, if I could just get to that page here. And so he should have responsibility as he didn't file the taxes. Again, no documentation was presented other
that,
than
that was a conclusion of law. 54. I see the tax liability.
Yes. And so the $50,000 was previously a part of the order that the court issued when Mr. Konkamala had made a motion to force my client to sell all of the homes to pay for the business debt. So the challenge here is if the judge would not have ordered that the parties share in the ownership of Storworks, Mr. Konkamala would have been in a position, as he negotiated away all five of the parties' homes, to settle the business debt. So if you read the bankruptcy document that was agreed to by Mr. Konkamala after the divorce was filed, it says, bank, you go ahead and you foreclose on all the homes, which would have left my client with nothing.
So I just want to clarify, is your position then that the findings of fact are not deficient because there are a number of issues that are being raised on appeal that were not raised before the district court, so that's why the district court didn't discuss them in its order?
Correct. The district court did not have the facts presented to them on the taxes and that there really was liability. There was some testimony that there's going to be or there might be, but there was no this is what the liability is going to be. There was some personal guarantees that were talked about, but there was no evidence of these personal guarantees that were actually put forward other than the bankruptcy document.
So the tax liabilities, personal guarantees, what else are you arguing was not is being raised on appeal but wasn't raised before the district court?
So the division of property takes into account the $50,000 that was previously addressed in a prior order that was bankruptcy fees, that was attorney's fees by Mr. Konkamala. And while the court did not specifically make that $50,000 determination or factual finding in that order, it previously had. You'll find in the order related to the denial of the order for the sale of property, there was an attorney's fees request there and a $50,000, a request that my client pay the $50,000. And the court found that Mr. Konkamala may be attempting to shift these expenses onto my client.
Did the district court ask for proposed findings of fact by the parties?
Yes, they did.
And did the appellant include the personal guarantee as part of the findings?
I believe they did. They did not, ask to take on the $50,000 loan from the 401k.
I'm sorry. They also included the $50,000 and the personal guarantee.
They did. They believe that the personal guarantees should have been divided.
I hear what you're saying. Well, the parties didn't present it clearly, but if it's in the findings of fact that a party proposes, isn't that in the district court's radar that something that the district court should resolve as a matter of fact? I mean, it's clearly a disputed issue of fact if parties are talking about it and then the parties address it in their findings of fact.
So the issue is, did the court see it as a marital issue or was it a business issue that was dealt with by the bankruptcy court? The court is bound by the bankruptcy order, and in fact, the bankruptcy documents specifically say no party may go after the collection of these debts. They're not real debts because the bankruptcy court has said nobody can collect them. There was testimony throughout the 6 days of trial that the bankruptcy plan was feasible, that they believed that it was doable. It, over and over and over again, we were told that they were making the payments, they were making them on time, and they expected they were going to successfully complete. If that happens, there is no personal guarantee, there is no risk, there is no liability.
Is it fair to say that you were probably also surprised by the brevity of the findings of fact?
I propose all sorts of long findings of fact and conclusions of law all the time, and I quite often don't get long findings of fact and conclusions of law that we all would like to see. However, I believe that the court record is clear here. I believe that Judge Burns made a tremendous effort to do a fair and equitable division, and I believe that the record does reflect that there are findings and that this is a proper order, and I do believe that you should affirm it.
That was the most persuasive non-answer I've heard.
What are the findings that get us there? What are the pivotal findings that you say are supported by the record and that would permit us to review and glean whether, in fact, the district court acted within or without its discretion?
So one of the most significant things, so my client asked for spousal maintenance. These parties have had significant assets throughout the course of their marriage together. They acquired 5 homes and 3 businesses, and 4 of those homes are used for rental income. So while Mr. Konkamala talks about the division of the homes, he doesn't talk about the ongoing income that he's going to get from those rental homes. He doesn't live in any of them.
Well, but isn't that also, I mean, rental income is baked into the valuation of real property. When you're looking at an asset, you're not just considering the sale value of the, I mean, the sale value, the market value incorporates the value as an income-producing property also, doesn't it?
When we did these, we did not because of the risk that they may have been taken back by Choice Bank. So we did real clear what is the value of these properties as they are if they were sold or taken by the bank, because there was the risk that the bank would take the properties throughout the course of the entire divorce.
Well, the parties stipulated to the fair market value of the properties and the rental income associated with them.
Correct. And so so I believe that takes that into account as well when Mr. Konkamala was awarded what he was awarded. In addition, my client had requested spousal maintenance. And if you specifically look, I believe it's page 8 of the order, item number 43, the court indicates that my client's monthly income isn't enough to cover the expenses, that she'll be getting some child support, but she'll still be $884 short for her monthly income need. But he believes that the additional division of property will take care of that issue. So he does, in fact, address that as an issue. In addition, my client's home was in foreclosure, the home that her and the children live in. Oh, my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes.
Certainly, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Very briefly, I'll try to be concise. Page 21 of appellant's brief notes the issue of the particular debt. Expert report for appellant notes personal guarantee as of October 31, $3.5 million. Both parties provided testimony. The transcript is cited to my client as personally guaranteed debt. I signed, respondent testified. First off, I didn't sign those personal guarantees. He did. That is in appellant's brief at page 21. In reply brief at page 10, similarly, and I apologize, I'm jumping around here. There's a lot to cover. I'm going to omit that. If we go to the proposed orders, I included them in the addendum for appellant so that the court can actually see what was addressed and what wasn't addressed. Page 46 of appellant's proposed order, addendum page 46, deals with liabilities, estimated tax liability, $285,000. It also then goes into the proposed balance sheet, which includes the personal guarantees, and also, apologize, here, page 48. Strike that. I must have written that wrong. So there was testimony regarding the personal guarantees and tax liability. It was addressed in appellant's proposed order. Certainly, also, Your Honor, I think it's a misstatement at best to identify that because parties stipulate to valuations in an asset and liability list to expedite trial, certainly there was no stipulation as to allocation. As to the actual...
Can I jump in real quick? I know you're short on time. You're trying to get a lot in.
Yep.
Were these issues... sometimes district courts ask for simultaneously filed findings of fact. Did the parties simultaneously provide findings of fact, or did the respondent have a chance to address all of these issues?
You're putting me on
their findings.
I don't mean to interrupt. To the best of my recollection, and please take this with a grain of salt, Your Honor. It has been a bit of time. My recollection is it was simultaneous initial and then opportunity for response, but please don't hold me to that.
Do you recall whether both parties addressed the issues that you're talking about in the proposed findings?
I don't recall respondent's position, Your Honor, as it relates to the personal guarantees nor the tax liability within the proposed findings. I apologize, Your Honor. I will note, though, that if we go to page 13, and this is appellant's addendum, page 13, and also district court, page 13, estimated tax liability is addressed within the order. So I have a hard time understanding how between testimony, proposed orders, and itself making it into the record itself that the tax liability wasn't somehow properly addressed. I don't really know what else was supposed to happen there. As to the issue with regard to a lot of what I think the court heard, it is simply connecting dots in a way that benefits one side. It really is. And frankly, appellant, I suppose, could try to connect the dots that district court made in a way that would try to benefit him. But it's an insufficient order to say that if we put all of these pieces from a temporary order that happened previously, and if we take these findings over there, and if we then kind of infer how the district court did this part to get to that part, honestly, if that's what we have to do to try to divine intent, the intent is not clear. And so it is an insufficient position or argument, in my opinion, to simply say the court intended to benefit one party. Here's how that, you know, could be read together in a way that would benefit that party, and therefore the order should be upheld. So unless the court has other questions, I think that I've tried to respond to the issues as briefly as I could. They are raised in the brief. They are raised within the addendum. The issues are addressed within the district court order, at least as it relates to the tax liability. So those issues certainly were before the district court. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Thank you both, counsel. Appreciate the oral arguments and the briefing. Very helpful in terms of trying to clarify these issues. So we appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both.